I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
C-13 Originals.
Tell the guards to let people in as quick as you can. We got to get started.
Just let them all come in as long as they got room, anyway.
You know, it's a real brunette, ain't you? Don't care, not. You about ready to start?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Yes, sir. I'm like everything squared out.
You got everybody in there?
We've got everybody.
The committee will come to order.
This is the voice of Strom Thurmond, the late senator from South Carolina.
Yesterday, in our organized crime hearing, we focused on outlaw motorcycle gangs. We received testimony from agents of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, which linked outlaw motorcycle gangs and the La Cosa Nostra. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms testimony also disclosed the gang's propensity for violence, as well as that total disregard for human dignity and the rights of others. Outlaw motorcycle gangs such as the Pagans, Hells Angels, Outlaws, and the Bandidos are involved in murder, drug distribution, prostitution, rape, theft, and extortion. We are told of the criminal activities and the lifestyles of the gang members as seen from the standpoint of law enforcement authorities. Today, we will hear from individuals who have actually been outlaw motorcycle gang members and participated in these activities. They will tell their stories and disclose some of the inner workings of the gangs. Now, our first witness this morning is Butch. Butch is a federally protected witness, and in order to protect his safety, no information concerning his present residence or identity is being provided. We appreciate the cooperation of the Department of Justice and the U.S. Marshals Service in making this witness available. Mr. Vita, you have any remarks you want to make at this time about the witness?
Yes, Senator, I'd briefly like to describe his background, if I could, for you. Butch is a 43-year-old member of the Cleveland, Ohio chapter of the Hells Angels Motorcycle Gang. He has been a member of that gang for 14 years. He was a founding member of the Bandido Motorcycle Gang in Texas in 1966. In 1967, he left the Bandidos and went into the Rodbenders Motorcycle Gang in Florida. From there, he went to the Reapers Motorcycle Gang in Houston, Texas, then back to the Bandidos, where he eventually took charge of their Nomad chapter. He left the Bandidos and rejoined the Hells Angels in late 1967. In 1968, he helped reestablish the Cleveland's Hells Angels chapter. In 1969, he became vice president of that chapter. In 1970, he was club sergeant at arms, remaining in that position until 1971, when he pled guilty to manslaughter charges. He was sentenced to a workhouse in Warrenville Heights, Ohio, until his release in 1972. From 1972 until 1981, Butch was actively involved in national runs and other membership affiliations of the Hells Angels. Butch can explain how one becomes a member of and the significance of colors. He can give detailed accounts of crimes committed by motorcycle clubs. He can testify as to the function of old ladies, prospects, and hangarounds. He can tell of territorial disputes, as well as social and business affiliations with other biker gangs and organized crime. According to Butch, the book The Godfather was used to reorganize the Hells Angels along the lines of traditional organized crime. Senator, your witness.
Thank you. Now, Butch, would you be sworn at this time. Just raise your hand and be sworn.
Yes, sir.
The evidence you give in this hearing
should be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
Yes.
What good's a man who's lost his soul? Can't take a stand when his flame's gone cold. Fend off the enemy, sing out the jubilee with all the fire we can breathe.
I'm Jackie Taylor, and this is Relative Unknown.
Butch.
Yeah.
This is Bukovich.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me lay it out just the way it comes, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Back in November of 1981, when my father, Butch Crouch, made the decision to call Bernie Butkovich of the Cleveland ATF, he'd put himself in an impossible position. He wanted out of the Hells Angels, and he thought rolling over and working a deal to put us all into witness protection was the safest way to accomplish that. So when he went back to Ohio and was interviewed by Butkovich and his supervisor, Steve Wells, he gave them information on various crimes committed by other members. But they told him that in order to cut a deal with the government and become a protected witness, he needed to give them something that he had direct involvement in.
Okay, give me some homicide victims that you were involved in. Not you, but...
That I was involved in?
I'm not saying, hey, tell me who did what. Just tell me what you know. In other words, you know about so-and-so getting their head popped. You know about a certain bombing. You see what I'm getting at?
From my understanding, they had told him that he could confess to damn near anything except killing somebody, and he wouldn't get any time. So what's the first thing he does? He confesses to being involved in the murder.
This is Roger Davidson, former Summit County prosecutor in Akron, Ohio, which is where the murder occurred that my father confessed to.
Clarence Crouch, when he told the ATF about being involved in the murder, that was probably one of the most idiotic things that I have ever seen a defendant do, other than flat out confessing to a murder after your rights are read to you. Why he just didn't shut up at that point in time, get a lawyer at that point in time, if there was no way around discussing the murder, have some kind of deal set up. But he did not. He just started blabbing. And the ATF agents had their oh shit moment.
My father had assumed that when he called Bernie Butkovich, he'd end up with little to no time.
Okay, you may have to plead out to one felony. Probably an ATF type of case, okay?
I have to plead out to a felony?
And Butkovich thought that my father would implicate himself in some small felony and then help him dismantle the Cleveland Hells Angels.
You mean I got to cop to a felony and do time?
Yeah, that's the way it's laid out here from the Strike Force people.
That don't sound right.
But when Butch confessed to the unsolved murder of a 17-year-old, it put them both behind the eight ball.
The visuals of the ATF coming in and asking for mercy for a murderer is not very good. And that's what they were going to start having to ask the court for. Judge, you can't give this guy a ton of absolute time, or he ain't going to help us convict some of these guys that I want to convict. That was the oh shit for him. Shortly after that's when they brought him to us to talk to him and to get him a lawyer so they could handle the state case as quickly and expeditiously as possible to get themselves out from under the bus and still try to keep cooperating with him.
But before he could even be used as a witness during any trials, they had to put that murder to bed. And to put that murder to bed, my father would have to agree to plead guilty to it. Now he had some leverage. Remember, during this time, my mom had taken us to Sebring, Florida to get away from him, and we were happy there. But my father wouldn't plead guilty unless we were all taken into WITSEC together.
What about my old lady and kids?
Chances are, if you want your lady and kids, they're going to go with you.
That's a crucial detail that I'll come back to later. But here's another important detail. He was able to demand that his plea agreement and sentencing would be taken care of before he testified in any trial. Lawrence Whitney was the Akron defense attorney who handled the plea proceeding.
Normally, a testifying co-defendant would enter into an agreement with the government about what the sentence would be. Then he would enter a plea of guilty. And he wouldn't be sentenced until the government was convinced that he fulfilled his bargain. Did he testify? Did he testify truthfully? And the judge could take all of those things into consideration in determining what to do with him at time of sentencing. But this case, he pled and he was sentenced all at the same time, which was, it would be something I would want to do as a defense lawyer, but normally something that the prosecutors do not want to do. They want to make sure that he follows through. So they were convinced that he would follow through.
Before knowing what kind of witness he would be or how truthful his testimony would be, my father secured his guilty plea in stone, 10 to 40 years for manslaughter. It was more than he'd expected, but he knew he'd confessed to a murder and he was ready to get on with it. Signing the deal at that point was just a formality. Here is Lawrence Whitney again.
I stayed up there in the prosecutor's office waiting for him to come. I remember being in towards the end of the day. It was a long day for me, so I shut the door and waited for them to come, and I kind of relaxed a little bit. And frankly, I put my feet up on the desk. I unbuttoned my tie. And I'm kind of with my head back. I'm trying to slow down for the day, and all of a sudden, door opens. And here come the marshals with him in tow. There had to be a couple of those guys and him in the middle of them, and they walk in the office, and he stops. And I look up at him, and he looks down at me. He said, well, what did they do? Did they put a tie on the fucking janitor? That's what he said. That was the first time I met the man.
I'm Lauren Sherman, the writer behind Puck's Fashion and Beauty Memo line sheet. And I'd like to welcome you to my new show, Fashion People. On every episode of Fashion People, I'll be talking to insiders about the stuff we're all whispering between the press releases, from M&A rumors to celebrity stylist dish to the future of legacy media. Be sure to follow and listen to Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, available on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you wake up in a cold sweat from your work dreams?
Have a coworker who keeps inviting you to do escape rooms?
Can't get a coworker to agree to do escape rooms?
Or are you just genuinely not sure how to take the next step in your career?
I'm Kate.
And I'm Kim. And together we run Amy Poehler's company, Paper Kite Productions.
We've been friends and colleagues for years, so we know how important it is to feel like someone has your back at work.
And we want to be that for you.
So we're hosting a weekly advice show where we answer all your work-related questions.
Something amazing happened. I got offered my dream job.
How am I supposed to bring this up to him without hurting his feelings? What should I do?
I want to skip the pleasantries without being an asshole.
Careful, money and friends, they don't mix, babes.
They don't. And don't work with your friends, make your friends at work.
All right, I can't believe I'm going to say this, but that was actually $1 million advice.
Whether you need advice or just love to listen to other people's problems, this show is for you.
Listen and follow Million Dollar Advice, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, Butch, would you be sworn at this time? Just raise your hand and be sworn. The evidence you give in this hearing should be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
Yes.
As part of his plea deal, Butch Crouch had agreed to testify in trials brought by local, state, or federal agencies and to provide information in any way those agencies requested. So on Thursday, March 3rd, 1983, as part of its hearing on organized crime in America, the United States Senate Judiciary Committee asked my father to give testimony about the inner workings of the Hells Angels. Nobody had ever done anything like this before. And so, under armed guard, they placed him behind a curtain to maintain his safety and anonymity. Only his brown leather shoes could be seen beneath the curtain. This is the actual audio of the hearing, with my father's real voice. Here, Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa asks him some questions.
As a member of this committee, I want to thank you very much for your willingness to come and testify, because this is a very important hearing. I have several questions. Did the Hells Angels ever commit any acts of violence on behalf of any traditional organized crime families?
Yes.
Could you elaborate?
Well, in 1977, they were taking contracts from the Mafia from different fractions. There was an Italian fraction that was working. There was a war going on between them and Danny Green's fraction. And I know that they were taking contracts, hits for the Irish fraction side of it. And in 77, one of the members, a Hells Angel member, he was also an intelligence officer there, which I'll get into later. He was setting a bomb on a car that belonged to one of the Italian guys, and the bomb blew up and he was killed.
Here, he's speaking about when Hells Angel Enos Cernick was killed while placing a bomb on the car of a Cleveland mob associate.
And at that time, the president, we had a meeting, and the president was elected to go talk to the Italian fraction and tell them that this guy was not in the club at the time that he was killed, and try to keep out of it because we didn't want to get between the two fractions or whatever.
How many contract killings were conducted?
A couple that I know of. Just a couple that I know of.
At least two.
Aware of, yeah.
At least two. Was that on the behalf of the Mafia against the Irish?
No, the other way.
The other way.
Yeah, the Irish against them. It's Danny Green's fraction against the Italian fraction.
What is the role of the intelligence officer in the Hells Angels, and what type of intelligence information do the Hells Angels maintain?
Intelligence officer was established back in 74, 73, and it was an office to gather all the information they could on the outlaws, pagans, any club in the United States, any police officer, any newsman, anybody that the Hells Angels had a grudge against. And they gathered it up from all the different people they know, and they collect all their addresses, types of cars, what girls they used to go with or whatever. And they have a saying in Hells Angels that came out in the paper a long time ago, back in 71 or so, that Hells Angel has a memory like an elephant, he never forgets. And that's quite a common saying now. So if they have a grievance with somebody, it never ends. The intelligence officer goes to different towns. He's supplied with money from the Treasury for that specific reason, from a TCB fund, which is taking care of business.
What's the primary source of these funds?
Primary source?
Yes.
Drugs, burglaries, whatever they can get their hands on.
Is it true that they are beginning to store intelligence information on computer tapes?
Over the years, all that information that people were gathering up was always on little pieces of paper on the back of cards or whatever, and they tried to keep it all together, and it just got all out of hand. And in 1980, there's a member in Cleveland who had a motorcycle shop. He had a computer in it. And so it was brought to the church one night.
By church, you mean a meeting of the club?
Yes, church. That's what they call a meeting.
The
church.
Term is
church, which is every week, and it's mandatory. So funds were taken out from the Treasury and paid for the computer to put all this information in the computer, which centralized everything, plus what members had rolled their bones and where they had rolled their bones, all the information, every bit of information.
Yeah, what's the term rolling your bones mean?
Well, a new member, when he joins a club, he has 6 months which in to roll his bones to kill someone. Once he gets his patch, and then he has to roll his bones within 6 months. If he don't roll his bones within 6 months, he loses his patch. He has to kill someone.
In order to become a full-fledged member, then they have to have committed a murder?
They're told that after they get their patch, and they'll have to kill someone. And if they renege on that, then they're killed.
Oh, you say if the person does not commit a murder, then he is killed?
Yes, because then he knows, and he knows too much.
At this point, I think it might be a good opportunity to tell us about the initiation process and continuing on then with the total induction into the Hells Angels.
All right. First, it's a hang around. When he first comes around the club, there's a lot of mud checking, he has to fight a lot of people. A lot of people jump on him. They jump on him in twos, threes. Then after a period of time, which it may be 3 months, it may be a year, 2 years, we'll have a vote, and it has to be 100% vote that he's allowed to be a hang-around. And then he becomes a hang-around. He can come into the clubhouse, and he can do flunky work. Then he becomes a prospect, and he can be brought up for prospect 3 times. If he's voted down 3 different times, so then they run him off. They beat him up, take his old lady, take his motorcycle, run him away. Then as a prospect, he's on 24-hour call. There's always a watch at the clubhouse. He stands watch upstairs. He's armed with, there's carbine shotguns, there's twilights up there, the scopes, there's scanners, everything. They have a security room in the top of the clubhouse. And he sits there at night from 12 o'clock till daylight.
How formal or ceremonial is the initiation process?
Well, there's usually a big party, a lot of drinking, fighting, just, it's toned down from years before. It used to be everybody would urinate on them, everybody would throw grease on them, things like that. And they would have to do things to women and all that.
Senator Grassley then asks my father about the club's treatment of women.
It's a whole different set of rules for women. They're allowed in the clubhouse all the time. There's people pick girls up on the street hitchhiking and stuff like that, bring them in, keep them around the clubhouse a couple of days. Everybody uses, abuses them, then they run them off. Some that's older, they turn out.
What do you mean by turn out?
Turn out, prostitution. Tell them to go down to Charlotte or whatever, work down there in the massage parlors. California, there's a lot of prostitution. New York, all the old ladies up there work topless bars, sell drugs. That's about the same criteria for everybody all the way across.
The money comes back to the gang member or?
Yes, it comes back to
him
the gang.
As an individual?
Yes, all of it, all of it.
The questioning turns from women to the Hells Angels' war with the outlaws. Many of the killings in Cleveland that my father wrote about, told the ATF about, and took part in, centered around this war. Here, he talks about how it began in 1974, the year I was born.
In Florida, I went down to investigate the killing of 2 Hells Angels and an ex-Hells Angel back in 74. There was 2 members that had quit the club, and they were from the Laurel Mass Charter. Well, 2 members from the Laurel Mass Charter were sent down there to make sure that they had their tattoos covered. And while they were there, they were in a motorcycle shop, and the outlaw motorcycle gang came there on them. And these 2 people were found shot in the back of the head with a shotgun, and 1 ex-member was found. And they were all in a pond, some kind of rock pit that's just outside of town. And the club sent me down there to investigate it, me and another member from New York City. We'd seen all the autopsies and all the reports and things like that. And we went and talked to the outlaws. We set up a meeting with them. And then we went and talked to the guy that owned the motorcycle shop. We talked to approximately about 30 people down there. And after we were down there maybe 10 days, we had found out that they had done it, and they had done it in their clubhouse on a ruse that they was going to take them over there and cover their tattoos or something like that. And took them out and shot them in the head. So we reported back that the outlaws had done it. So then they had a big officers' meeting, and they declared all-out war on the outlaws. And all the charters.
What was the nature of these meetings? Were they formal meetings or just?
No, they have an officers' meeting every 3 months. All the East Coast, and there's usually a West Coast representative there. There's an East Coast and a West Coast, and Omaha is the borderline. And the meeting was held in Cleveland, and they decided, all right, we're going to have all-out war against the outlaws. And the war, there was a lot of bombings, a lot of shootings, a lot of killings.
How many people were killed during that year?
There's at least 15 that I know of right offhand. I could probably come up with more.
15 people killed?
Yes, just outlaws. There was other people killed along at the same time.
How many Hells Angels were killed?
Hells Angels? Yeah, there's 5 or 6 that I'm personally aware of.
5 or 6 Hells Angels were killed?
Yes.
Now, what brought on this thing? Was it something about removing tattoos or covering the cold?
All Hells Angels have a tattoo. It's mandatory. 9 days after you get your patch, you must have your Hells Angel tattoo, and it's all taken from the same stencil.
9 days after you get your patch, you have to have...
9 days. Hell's Angels, the Death Head, and the what? The Death Head, the skull with wings. And
the skull is all that tattooed?
The whole thing is tattooed. Hell's Angels, the emblem, the MC, and the bottom rocker, whatever state you're from. There's been incidences where people with tattoos, phony Hell's Angel tattoos, have had them cut off their arms, had the whole tattoo just removed with a knife.
If they had a tattoo, they would just take a knife
and cut it off,
and cut enough flesh off to get rid of the tattoo?
Yes. It was considered quite a trophy. There's only cuttings on the arms. I never heard of anyone getting their back cut off, although I did cut an outlaw.
Now, did that include cutting trophies off of outlaws as well as other people who...
Yes, I was in Memphis in 76, 77, and I was in a tattoo shop getting a tattoo on my arm. A lot of outlaws walked in, and one of the outlaws had a Outlaws Memphis on his back with their center logo, and I put 180 stitches in his back with a big X through it.
Put 180 stitches in his back?
Yes.
Was that reported to police? Was anything ever done about it?
They tried to catch me, but I got out of town.
What size piece of flesh did you cut off of him?
I didn't cut it off of him. I just put a great big X in it.
Huh?
I just put a great big X in it. It's been in magazines.
You put a big X on him just to mark it out?
Yes.
And why did you do that? What was the purpose?
I made him an ex-member.
Let's get quiet. Get quiet.
Every person who gets picked up by the feds or state law enforcement agencies get told the old phrase, first in, first out. The first person that comes in here and snitches is the first one that's going to get out of jail. That's the theory of prosecutions all over the United States, and that's what every criminal knows.
Journalist Bill Mushi gave an unprecedented inside view of the witness protection program in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette in 1996, and he says information is currency.
I've seen cases just recently where I told my wife, that person better get his or her butt into the office and rat somebody out, or they're going to go do everybody else's time. That's the way the convicts look at it. They think the ones that are in prison screwed up by not going and ratting people out early, and they all figure they're doing somebody else's time because that person ratted them out. It started in 1964 with Joe Valachi, the first mafia turncoat. More than anything, that's when prosecutors realized that snitches were the coin of the realm. The entire prosecution system after Valachi started leaning towards the idea of a snitch culture. Instead of doing good old-fashioned gumshoe police work, prosecutors and agents started just saying, who can we get to rat somebody out? Then we'll build a case around what the rat says. That's what caused the increase of the program, which was doubling every couple of years. And that's a direct relationship to the idea that we became a snitch culture back in the late 60s, and it still exists to this day. Name a case that you've ever seen where there's not a snitch over the last 20 years. I can't name one, and I've been covering crime my whole life.
Mushi says that over the decades, a hierarchy has formed among protected witnesses. The more valuable his information, the better the deal. You may have heard of Sammy the Bull Gravano, the notorious underboss for the Gambino crime family in New York, whose testimony helped bring down John Gotti.
Well, Gravano pulled the best deal that's ever been made in the history of the WITSEC program. He had amassed millions and millions of dollars, and the government didn't seize his money. In court, he said he killed 18 people. By the time they were done cross-examining him, he admitted to 23 killings, and he said, 18, 23, whatever. And he then worked a deal where he did about 5 years and change, or less than 3 months a body. He had some leverage over them, it's simple as that. And he gets out, moves to Arizona, where I even knew where he was, and the people in the WITSEC prison he was in had a pull going on how long it would be before he got arrested again. And sure enough, he and his family got busted for being the largest ecstasy distributors in the United States. Now he's doing 20 years in Arizona now. But that was all of his own making. If he would have stuck with the feds, he could have lived the life of Riley. But the thing about it is there's not that many stars. The lion's share of people feel like they were ripped off. Everyone I've ever talked to felt the same way, is that they were the star until their testimony was over with, and then they were the pieces of shit that they really are in the eyes of the government.
Now I want to ask you a question. Whether or not it's true that the Hell's Angels provide security for entertainers at rock concerts?
Yes, they do.
Do you know of any Hell's Angels that have turned against the rock stars?
It's one incident that I'm aware of that happened over a killing at a concert. And this one band, the club felt that the band didn't stand behind them. They had hired them to do security
work.
When
you speak of a band, now what do you mean by a band?
This rock band, this one specific rock band that I'm talking about. They had thrown a concert and someone was killed there. Well, they felt that this rock club should have stayed behind them and said that they had hired them for security around the bandstand or whatever, but they didn't, they just left. So there's always been more or less an open contract on this band and this person. And there's been two attempts that I know of that failed.
Two attempts at what?
To kill him. One.
To kill the rock concert man?
Yeah, one was.
Well, did they ever kill him?
No.
I won't ask you his name in public. We may want to ask you in executive session. Unless you want to disclose his name now, if you want to disclose it now.
It's Mick Jagger and the Rolling Stones. It's from the Altamont thing. One charter.
You might tell us more about the attempts on his life.
One attempt was made where they sent a member with a gun and a silencer to a hotel, and he stalked that hotel for a long time, but they didn't show up. Then the next attempt was a few years later, somewhere around 79, somewhere around in there, when they were in New York City for a concert or something. They had some place near water, and I was told that they were explaining to me how they did it. They had swam over and checked the place out at some house near water or something, and they was going to put a bomb up underneath it. And they were going to blow the whole band and everybody in the party up. And they were crossing there, and they had a pontoon boat, a little rubber raft thing with plastic explosives in it, and they lost it in the water.
The Hell's Angels denied the idea of any attempt being made on Mick Jagger's life. And though it made for entertaining headlines, nothing more came of this part of my father's testimony.
Could you tell us just how you got your bones? That means how you killed somebody, doesn't it?
Yes, sir. I got mine from the Polish Women's Hall, and that dates back to 71. So, and we started the bones thing around 73.
Is that the first time you killed somebody?
Yes, in that hall.
Go ahead.
We went to the hall, we walked in the hall, and here they came. It's about 208 of them come marching in the doors. And they all came in, and everybody was shoulder to shoulder, and the fight got off. When the fight got off, I started punching people, and I kept hitting this one kid. I hit him once, and I went to somebody else, and out of the corner of my eye, I see he didn't go down. I turned around and hit him again, and I noticed his eyes was rolling back. And I looked up over his head, and there was an arm coming down with a knife in it, and he stuck me in the chest. So I pulled my knife and hit him, and I killed him. That was the first person I ever killed. I went on and got stabbed again, and I got stabbed in the back, and I woke up on the floor with my knife sticking in some guy. One Hell's Angel was stabbed to death. 28 Breed were stabbed, cut to pieces. I was stabbed four times. But we stopped that club. There's no charters in Cleveland. There's no charters in Ohio. Or there's no charters in PA or anything like that anymore. Then the Outlaw War came along. And the killings just kind of got out of hand. There was women and children killed.
Women and children were killed?
Yes.
Well, why were they killed?
They were killed along with outlaws.
Accidentally or intentionally?
Senator, there's some pending litigation in Cleveland at this time regarding the particular incident that the witness is alluding to. So we would ask the senator's permission not to answer that particular question.
That'd be all right. All right, counsel has a few questions.
Maybe did you kill other people that after that one murder?
Yes. Yes.
How many murders have you committed total?
One other one. One.
Two total.
One. Well, the one in the hall was self-defense, I felt. But anyway, then there was one more. There was, and they got on my case at church in 74.
Now, who is they, if you would?
Intelligence. They started screaming, you know, that I hadn't done anything, me and another member, that we hadn't done anything towards the outlaws. And they said they're just going to have to do something. And I said, all right, well, I was ready to do something. So they told me to just wait, and intelligence security would set something up. So in a few days, they came by and said, here's a shotgun, cut it down. And I cut down the shotgun.
And you sawed it off?
Yes, cut down the barrel, cut down the stock. And waited for a couple more days. They said that they'd come by and pick me up. They had all the information in place. It was supposed to be an outlaw meeting. And they came by and picked me up. And I was sitting in the front seat. One guy had a machine gun sitting in the back seat. The other guy had a .45 that was driving. And I never really thought it would go down. We drove down there. They'd already set it up and made the runs on it, I guess, and checked it all out. And they had a car stashed down there, another car. And we drove down there, and it all just took place, boom, just like that. They drove straight to it, and there was a bunch of people standing outside, and it was dark. And we pulled up and stopped, and the machine gun opened up, and I started shooting. And I shot a window out, and I shot a bike, and I shot up the driveway, and I hit somebody, which is more or less why I'm sitting here, because it turned out to be a 17-year-old kid, and that was the only other killing I ever did.
So you were arrested in conviction for that murder?
Yes,
murder.
I played, yeah.
Right.
You're serving time for that now, are you?
Yes. It was an unsolved murder till I confessed to it.
What is the goal in life of the Hells Angels, and why did you join the Hells Angels?
I joined because of a brotherhood. We were one family, one big family, we were all brotherhood. We would all stay together, and our kids would be Hells Angels, and you know, it was something that that we'd all grow old and be proud of.
We're singing all day, and you can't tame it. High tide, low tide, you know, night time, the morning time, yeah. We're going strong, headed up, down the river. Oh, Lord, I feel the reveling. I feel a change on the rise.
Next time on Relative Unknown.
What we learned about Butch Crouch was not good news as far as being a good witness.
He was going to be an awful hard sell to a jury if his word was all we had to go on.
My father comes face to face with his former Hells Angels brothers in the courtroom.
He was coming up with statements. There was people getting killed almost every day. You know, come on.
For episode transcripts and story extras, visit relativeunknown.com. Relative Unknown is a creation and presentation of C13 Originals, a division of Cadence 13, and Rumor Inc. Executive produced by Chris Corcoran, Zach Levitt, David Balinson, Michael Galinsky, and Suki Holly. Written, produced, directed, and edited by Zach Levitt. Produced and edited by Perry Kroll. Our theme song is Change on the Rise by Avi Kaplan. Original music composed by Joel Goodman. Mixed and mastered by Bill Schultz. Production support by Ian Mont and Lloyd Lockridge. Field recording by Rich Berner, Michael Galinsky, Perry Kroll, and Connor Waddingham. Production engineering and coordination by Sean Cherry and Terrence Malingone. Artwork, marketing, and PR by Kurt Courtney, Josephina Francis, and Hilary Schuff. I'm Jackie Taylor, and thanks for listening to Relative Unknown.
I feel a change on the rise. Oh.
change on the rise.
They said it couldn't be done. They say it bordered on impossible.
When someone says I can't do something, I usually agree with them.
And now, against all odds, this completely mediocre comedy podcast has done the unthinkable. They got listeners.
We got listeners.
No way.
Amazing.
Now available on the Odyssey app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm so happy we're at Odyssey now.
Oh my God, they're amazing.
The Commercial Break Podcast. You heard it here last.